This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
3526-4000, extension 316, or email volunteer at kpft.org. KPFT Houston.
Good morning and welcome to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host. Pleasure to be with you. It is July 24th. I am actually not live. I am coming to you on a pre-record as I am still on an extended vacation in Portland, Oregon. My little boy is taking a bath. I think he wants to get out. So I'm going to try to cover a number of news items that have been building up over the past few weeks and comment on them. And also want to get to a very interesting email that I got. Where is this thing? This is a reader comment that was posted on our website, on our show from a few weeks ago called Not Now You Know. I was talking about the issue of drilling that has come up, the McCain and the Bush drill here, drill now, drill forever, and so forth. And again, you can find that show on our website, newcapitalshow.com, Now You Know. And I issued a call for people in the industry to call in or contact me about what they know about our oil reserves. And EGM Initials has this the following, posted this. Very interesting comment. He says, I didn't hear from strategic planning people working for a major answer your request to call in to discuss reserves in the continental U.S. I am a geologist working for a small independent here in Texas. I just wanted to add what I could to the oil reserve debate from my perspective. So this is great. I love it. Here goes EGM on a long, not too long, it's a few paragraphs long, but he's going to tell us what he knows about oil reserves in this debate. He says, everybody talks about reserves, but reserves by themselves don't mean anything to me. For illustration, one could discover a billion-barrel oil field, but if it was learned that each well drilled at a cost of several million dollars into the field could only produce at a rate of one barrel of oil a day, then that field would be abandoned as uneconomic, and those reserves would just sit there as useless. I have found through the years that people don't typically understand the time value of money. Oil companies are typically looking at risking millions of dollars to drill a single well. The majors look at projects whereby the investment may be hundreds of millions of dollars before any cash flow is seen. This cash flow has to do more than pay off the cost of the project. It must outperform an alternate investment that returns a reasonable rate of return, say 8% to 10%. Because of the compounding nature of interest rates, the longer a project takes to deliver initial cash flow, the harder it is to catch the compounding curve. And by the way, EGM here sounds like he knows an awful lot about finance as well as geology. Let me read that again. He says, because of the compounding nature of interest rates, the longer a project takes to deliver initial cash flow, the harder it is to catch the compounding curve. Right? Again, that's because of the time value of money. This is Leo interjecting these comments. If the dollars from the project come later on in the project, dollars that come in later years are worth less than a dollar today. That's one of the principles of finance. A dollar today is worth more than a dollar tomorrow because of the effects of inflation. And that's what EGM is saying here. He says, why would anyone invest in an oil project if that money could outperform the oil project by just sitting in a bank and earn interest with little or no risk? Because companies must buy the leases, invest in seismic data, map the prospect, sell the prospect, secure a drilling rig, pay for drilling, pay for completion, and wait for a pipeline to be constructed. These bigger projects take years before production begins. That ticking clock will kill you, especially if you further delay things by drilling few dry holes before discovering a few oil. Nothing is certain in the oil field. Conversely, a smaller and less risky project may deliver cash flow soon after drilling, but it is still trying to catch that compounding interest rate curve. So catching that curve is also dependent on the rate that you can produce that gas or oil. Another fact of life for oil companies is that generally all production declines from the rate of initial production. Each day you are able to produce less than the day before. So oil companies are always looking at costs, time, risk, production schedules in an environment where the price of the product is uncertain. And I would add to what EGM is saying, not only is the price of the product uncertain, but all these other variables that he's talking about, time, risk, schedules, costs, labor costs, and so forth, all these things can be uncertain. And that's why I think a popular tool used in the oil exploration business is what's called Monte Carlo simulation, where different uncertain variables can be modeled, and you can get a probabilistic outcome. Back to EGM's letter, he says, why would one invest in a 10-year project if 10 years from now that product had the possibility of being worth half of what your projections allow? Nothing is certain in the oil field. Okay, let me go take care of my boy, and I'll be right back and finish this up. Okay, I'm back again. Let's continue on with EGM's letter. He says, now some fun with numbers. Let's say that we are going to replace the 14 million barrels of oil the country imports every day. There's been a lot of talk about this Bakken shale play in North Dakota. Let's say we are going to jump into this trend. Let's say every well we drill initially delivers 1,000 barrels per day. That's a pretty stout number. That means we need to have 14,000 new wells to meet our country's import needs. Now, we aren't going to build 14,000 new rigs to drill these holes simultaneously. We need to feel our way by devoting, say, 100 rigs to drill the effort. Furthermore, each of the wells would take a month to drill. That means if successful, we could deliver 100 rigs times 1,000 barrels per day, or 100,000 barrels per day, increasing by that amount every month. So we would need 140 months, nearly 12 years, to offset our current imports. By that time, the first wells are well on the way down the decline curve. So we need more than 100 rigs a day and more money at risk. At $3 million per well, how many companies are going to put $300 million up front without knowing the economics will pay out? And what's the probability that 7,000 wells in a row are going to produce 1,000 barrels of oil a day? Remember, nothing is certain in the oil field. And that ends EGM's note to us on the New Capital Show website. Clearly, this is a note from a professional who is indicating the vast uncertainties that exist when drilling and the daunting task that would face us in replacing all of our imports from domestic production, just using this one area in North Dakota, the Bakken play. And so what are we seeing on television, and what are we seeing from commentators? I'm here in Oregon. We don't have cable in our house in Houston, so it's here in this condominium that we're renting, and I'm astounded by what I see on what used to be, at least when I last saw them, reputable news shows like CNN. These stations are now manned by people like Lou Dobbs and Glenn Beck. I'm a radio show host, but I do it for 1 hour a week. That's what these people do. They're radio show hosts, and prior to being radio show hosts, they were disc jockeys. And so, our our reputable cable news organizations are now being manned and staffed and prognosticated by former disc jockeys. And what they do is pound their fist on the table, say, drill, drill, drill. We need to drill now. And here comes EGM into graciously into our forum chat rooms or forum bulletin boards and is highlighting for everybody the extreme difficulties and the extreme uncertainties that exist when we go to drill for oil. So that the fix that we're in right now is not going to go away in a day. It's going to take a lot of investment to be able to be able to do that. Another thing that he points out, which is that you can't even take the reserve numbers. Even if you take the reserve numbers, those reserve numbers are probably going to end up being on the low side, and they're going to end up being on the difficult side because, as EGM points out, there's a time value of money. These are investments, and it's not just the reserve or the oil that we think is there. It's what it takes to get it out of the ground. No profile, no geologic profile is the same as any other. And these are incredibly difficult technological feats to get oil out. Most of the low-hanging fruit in our country was drilled out long ago. And the low-hanging fruit that exists in the world now in terms of oil plays is in the Middle East, in places like Saudi Arabia, where the reserves are enormous. They're just not here anymore. So I want to thank EGM for that note to us. I think that, frankly, it really bears up what I've been saying, and frankly what those of us on the left and progressives have been saying, that we're not going to drill our way out of our energy problems. It's going to take a profile of alternative energy, but most of all right now it's going to take decreasing our consumption. 8 billion barrels of oil a year is a tremendous amount of oil, and until we get that consumption profile down, it's not going to make a lot of sense to drill in places where the production and the supply is going to be minuscule compared to what our demand is. It's going to make a difference, sure, to the purveyors and the owners of those oil strikes. And that's why there's such a push right now by industry and by people on the right, basically to reward industry, because it's going to make a difference to people who own oil. And if oil is selling for a high price and you can get your cost under well under whatever it takes to drill, it's going to reward them. But from a national perspective, it's not going to have much, if any, effect whatsoever. Now, in terms of reducing our consumption, it appears that we're starting to make some strides in that area. One of the things, and of course, higher oil prices are doing the job where we were not able to do the job before. So the oil prices and the gasoline prices that we're seeing at $4 a gallon plus, I've maintained for a long time, are not a bad thing. They're the thing that we really require to get the country moving in the right direction. If you don't believe it, just get a load of this headline. July 22nd, that's today. I'm talking into this microphone on Tuesday. You're hearing it on Thursday. Ford to make a broader bet on small cars. This is from New York Times. Dearborn, Michigan, the Ford Motor Company, which devoted itself for nearly 20 years to putting millions of Americans into big pickup trucks and SUVs, sport utility vehicles, is about to drastically alter its focus to building more small cars. The struggling automaker, reacting to what it sees as a rapid and permanent shift. That's the word here, permanent, a permanent shift. Ford believes this is a permanent shift in consumer tastes brought on by high gas prices, plans to unveil its new direction on Thursday, when it will report quarterly earnings, or as we've become accustomed to so many U.S. corporations in the auto business and in the finance business, what I like to call not earnings but losings. So when it will report, more than likely, its quarterly losings. Among the changes, Ford is expected to announce that it will convert three of its North American assembly plants, three, from trucks to cars, according to people familiar with the plans. Let's hope they can do that rapidly. I mean, let's hope that when they design these plants, at the very least they had in mind that they might need to convert the plants to from trucks to cars. I don't know anything about what is involved with that. I'm sure it's not the easiest thing in the world to do, to convert a manufacturing plant from making trucks to cars. But here's hoping that Ford's able to do it relatively rapidly, and hopefully when they designed those plants, they had an eye toward them being flexible and being able to be converted. No clue. I don't know. As part of the huge bet it is placing on the future direction of the troubled American auto industry, Ford will realign factories to manufacture more fuel-efficient engines and produce six of its next European car models for the United States market. The company will also end speculation about its Mercury division by making the brand an integral part of its new small car strategy, blah, 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 blah. The sweeping changes are the result of months of strategic discussions by Ford executives. Wow, months. They should have been at this years ago, and represent a dramatic response to the woes afflicting Detroit's automakers. U.S. vehicle sales have slumped 10% so far this year, with Ford down 14%, and the industry is headed for its worst annual sales in more than a decade. We know the rest. Ford in 2006 and 2007, the 2 years combined, lost $15.3 billion. $15 billion. Alan Mulally, the CEO, says, "We don't have a sustainable company if we don't do this." For at least a decade, about 60% of Ford's U.S. sales came from trucks and SUVs, compared to 40% from cars. Eight of the company's 14 plants in North America now build trucks. Got that? Eight of 14 plants, and so they're planning a conversion of three of those eight. So that will bring, so that means that nine of the 14 plants will now be doing cars. Ford is not alone in trying to dig itself out of a hole. Of course, General Motors finds itself in much the same position. It's working on the Chevy Volt. Stephen Reitman led our show last week through a discussion of that car, which is going to be a battery-powered car, hopefully with a very long-lasting battery plant, which will allow the car to go 40 miles on the battery alone before the gasoline engine kicks in. Right now, most hybrids will let you go a few feet before the gasoline engine kicks in. GM teams with dozens of utilities on plug-in cars. This is Wall Street Journal, July 22nd. Three dozen electric utilities and GM agreed to collaborate on smoothing a path for a plug-in electric vehicle that is slated to roll out in about 2 years. The collaboration is the first major effort by the two industries on an electric vehicle and includes some of the biggest names in the power sector. And then the article lists a bunch of these. AEP Austin Energy is there. Our friends right up the road in Austin, Texas, which is a local energy producer, Austin Energy, is involved in this. No surprise there. Both industries have a lot riding on the success of plug-in cars that will run largely on electricity, with gasoline or other fuels filling a supplementary role. Automakers need a hot-selling product to revive sales and hope the technology will slash gasoline consumption and reduce reliance on imported oil. Well, I don't know why this always says imported oil. Why does it have to be imported oil? How about just reduce reliance on oil? I mean, it's like this xenophobic thing that creeps in all over Americans, even finds its way into business reporting. You know, the oil, it's imported. We don't want it. It's imported. How about just reduce our consumption of oil, period, regardless of where the oil comes from. GM plans to introduce the Chevrolet Volt and the Saturn View as its first models. After more than a century of relying on gasoline as the main fuel for automobiles, GM and its rivals are scrambling to diversify energy sources. Automakers need the cooperation of utilities, right? Imagine that. They never had to talk to utilities before, and suddenly new alliances are having to be built. GM is having to talk with utilities since they control the new technology's primary fuel, electricity, and must make sure that the vehicle's recharging processes mesh with the electricity grid and don't inadvertently undermine grid reliability. So here's a whole other area where GM needs to look and needs to build business alliances with the electricity producers. And again, this should have been going on 8 years ago, but as we know, it hasn't. The good news is it's going on now, and it's going on in large part because we're looking at $4 gasoline. And what does the right wing want to do? You know, they want to push that price of gasoline down. It's killing everybody. And the reason is because, frankly, they're getting pushed out of power. What everybody's seeing now is that is that they have mismanaged the country. And they're trying to scramble and do everything they can to buy back votes and convince everybody that it's progressives and liberals and Obama and everybody else who are causing these problems. And, you know, if you believe that, you'll believe anything. That's just all I can say. If you believe that, you'll believe anything. This is the New Capital Show. I am going on and on while I'm out of town. Why don't we take a short music break, and when we come back, we'll turn and take a look at politics. We've been covering energy. NewCapitalShow.com. You can find us on the web there. Sign up for our notices. And when we come back, I also want to tell you about the article that appeared in the Houston Chronicle about our recycling petition and about recycling efforts in the city of Houston. Back in just a moment. Welcome back to the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold, your host, coming to you here on a recorded session. I'm recording on July 22nd. You're hearing me on July 24th. I hope you're having a terrific summer. I'm really having a great time up here in the Pacific Northwest in Portland, Oregon. I can't tell you how beautiful it is. What an interesting city Portland, Oregon is. They've made the investments, my friends. They've made investments, and they're making investments in recycling systems. They're making investments, and they've made investments in public transportation. It's a beautiful city, blessed with gorgeous scenery all around, wine country. But there's nothing that they're doing that other cities can't do. Nothing. There's absolutely nothing that Portland is doing that other cities can't do. They're just doing it here. And we need to do more. And as many of you know, we have been talking here on the New Capital Show about doing more in recycling, and we've been taking action here with the city to try to get that done. As many of you know, we had a recycling petition that ran for a month or so. We had 1,000 of you sign the petition, and then I and some other of you supporters and listeners went to city council. We did that a few weeks ago. I thought it was a highly successful visit. We had a great reception from the mayor. And I am told by the mayor's office that they are working on a formal response to the points of the petition, and hopefully they will have that to us soon. I don't know what they're going to say. I don't know what they're going to pursue. I don't know that the departments in the city are organized properly to be able to take up our ideas, but they're certainly getting a lot of play. I've seen a number of commentators picked up on the petition in the Houston Chronicle and elsewhere. And in fact, I awoke just a couple of mornings ago to several emails alerting me to the fact that our issue and our appearance had made the front page of the Houston Chronicle. Carrie Feibel, who writes for the Houston Chronicle, I'd done an interview with her, and this article apparently was believed to be important enough by the editors at the Houston Chronicle that it wound up on the front page. We've got a copy of it if you want to take a look at newcapitalshow.com under today's show. The title of the article is Incentives Could Boost Houston Recycling, Advocates Say. That's you and me. We're the advocates. and then the article starts out. It talks about the print edition of the Houston Chronicle contains 7 previous chronicles. It talks about, it's just kind of a little, artistic lead-in to the article. But then it gets down and dirty, no pun intended, on the issue of recycling. Daryl Lambert, who manages the Abitibi-Bowater Sorting Center. Abitibi-Bowater is a private contractor. It's a publicly traded company that's got recycling operations in numerous cities. They're also in the paper business. This is the guy who runs the sorting center where Houston sends its recyclables. He says, everything that comes out of your home or office is really a material stream that can be recycled or composted or even reused. There's very little true waste, which we know. We know that. But Houston isn't reclaiming those waste streams. Carrie Feibel says that may be, but it does not mean that Houston recycles as much as it could. Some residents blame the city's modestly scaled curbside program. But the city says that more recycling companies need to come to Houston, build processing centers, and ramp up the market for used goods. Okay, well, I mean, you know, for that to happen, there's going to have to be investment made. Harry Hayes, who's the solid waste director, which obviously is an important position in all this, the solid waste director says, Houston is a virtual gold mine of recyclable materials. It's just a matter of companies mining that material. You need to build it, and I think the material will flow. So apparently the city of Houston is, I mean, from these comments that are coming from these officials, they seem to be indicating that the city's gonna open up more for outside companies to come in and do business. I mean, frankly, we don't care. We just want it done. 2% rate is not acceptable, and as the article points out, Mayor White said recently, and when he said it at our city council meeting, he said, I think our current levels of recycling are unacceptable, and we need to do more. The city is on track to push its recycling rate toward 20%, White said. Well, yeah, okay, I mean, it may be on track, but how fast is it going to push it from 2% to 20%? I mean, see, that's how you have to read the news. Whenever an official says we're on track to push the recycling rate to 20%, your question should be, yeah, in what amount of time? 50 years or 1 year? Okay, so that comment leaves out one important variable. What's the time frame over which we're going to push the rate there? And I am naturally suspicious by nature, and so my antenna perk up, and so I don't tend to trust any kind of comment like that out of a public official, even out of our mayor. I want to know over what amount of time and what's reasonable to do. And then Mayor White says nobody is prevented from doing any of this, meaning nobody is prevented from participating in recycling. Kerry Feibel goes on to say critics say that approach, based on volunteerism and education, is not enough. And then here's a quote from yours truly. You are not going to educate the majority of people into recycling, says Leo Gold, a financial advisor who hosts a talk show on KPFT FM 90.1. The others have to be induced. It took $4 a gallon gasoline for people to get fuel-efficient automobiles, and it's going to take creative pricing to get people to do recycling, Gold added. And I believe that. I truly believe that. I think the people who can be educated are those people who have already been educated. People like you and me, people who are interested in the environment. But we're a small fraction of the population, and we're not going to be able to educate everybody in enough time. And so for that reason, we have to have, as I said, more creative ways to price trash. These are not punitive measures. It's not punitive that somebody or that the state requires you to get a driver's license. It's not punitive that you have to pay taxes to get city services. It's not punishment. We're not punishing people when we say that if you want a small garbage can, you should get a little one for free, but if you want a big one, you're going to have to pay for it. There's nothing punitive about these things. And as I learned when we went to city council, there are a number of council members who are laboring under that illusion that these are punitive measures. In this modern day and age, to run a modern recycling program and a modern waste management program, because the two are one and the same. And for too long, Houston has treated these things as separate, right? There's garbage collection, there's waste management. Oh, and then on the other side, there's recycling. No, these two things are two sides of the same coin about how we manage our waste. And I'm not sure that the city and that officials and council members yet get that. They still look at recycling as some sort of, you know, weird stepchild. And in other cities, it's not that way. I'm in Portland right now, and I was at my brother-in-law's for dinner the other night. And here in Portland, they are just now rolling out, or they've been rolling it out. You know, these things don't happen to every home overnight. But they just received at their home new recycling and garbage bins. And here's what they have here in Portland. Think about your garbage bin in the city of Houston, right? It's this big thing. Well, that's what they've been given here in Portland, two of those. One is green, one is plastic green. It's kind of a bright lime green, and the other is blue, okay? And the bright lime green is for yard waste. So all your yard waste goes into a covered bin on wheels. The blue one is for recycling. I think they take everything now except glass. And I don't know why they don't take glass here in Portland, but you know, maybe I'll find out. But I don't know why. Obviously, there's some complications in taking it in this bin. But they take everything back other than glass, and it's in a big bin, a big blue bin on wheels that's covered, so if cardboard goes into it and paper goes into it, the rain doesn't destroy it, which is such a huge problem, as you know, that we have with our recycling program. And these little bins, first of all, they're too small, and second of all, they're open to the elements. In Portland, they've taken care of that. It's a big bin, it's covered, it's on wheels, and then here's the other thing. When the truck comes, it does the same thing as our trash guys do. It picks it up automatically in those grips and it dumps it in. The sorting doesn't take place by the laborers who are picking up the trash. Portland has built a sorting facility, and I think the mayor alluded to that, and of course in this article Harry Hayes talks about building a single flow sorting facility. We need to invest in that here in Houston. And then, so those are the two bins, and then the third bin is the trash bin. And my friends, I tell you, the trash bin, also on wheels with a lid, it's half the size of the other two bins. It's half the size of the other two bins. So Portland, I think, is on the road to getting it exactly right. They've got a big yard waste bin, they've got a big recycle bin, and they have a small trash can. And so that's the way to do it. We'll put this article up on the website. There's a whole lot more in the article. Elena Marks, our friend at the city, who's the director of health and environmental policy, which frankly I don't understand why the solid waste department comes under the purview of health and environmental policy. I mean, okay, yeah, recycling is environmental, but again, this is really a solid waste issue. This isn't a public health issue, and frankly, to me, it's not so much an environmental issue. It's a waste disposal issue, and all we're saying is that, yes, the environmental way to dispose of waste properly is to recycle, but it's a solid waste issue, and frankly, to me, this system should be under the purview of staff that is trained in engineering large-scale industrial processes. This is not a public health issue, recycling and waste disposal. This is not an environmental policy issue. This is a plain old waste disposal issue, and we need to do it as well as we can do it. San Francisco, as I've pointed out in that original article that came in the New York Times a couple of months ago, is making money now on the waste that they take back and they recycle. The price of commodities has gone through the roof. I mean, you cannot imagine what corrugated cardboard is selling for. So, you know, there may even need to be reorganization in the way the city does things and the way the mayor organizes this. I have no idea. We'll see what comes back to them. There's big news that everybody needs to know about in the area of wind power here in Texas. Very big news released just this week. Texas approves a really $5 billion wind power project. Texas regulators have approved a wind power transmission project. That's transmission, providing a major lift to the development of wind energy in the state. The planned web of transmission lines will carry electricity from remote western parts of the state to major population centers like Dallas, Houston, Austin, and San Antonio. The lines can handle 18,500 megawatts of power, enough for 3.7 million homes on a hot day when air conditioners are running. The project will ease a bottleneck that has become a major obstacle to development of the wind-rich Texas Panhandle and other areas suitable for wind generation. Texas is already the largest producer of wind power, with 5,300 installed megawatts, more than double the installed capacity of California, the next closest state, and Texas is expanding fast. But, of course, the problem here is that we haven't had the transmission lines. Think about it. Why would there be transmission lines from West Texas to East Texas, where most of our cities are? There wouldn't have been such transmission lines that would have been created prior to wind power, because our power plants have been located and are located right now still in the east side of the state where the consumers are. So we have natural gas plants, coal plants, nuclear plants. All these plants are located in the east, and therefore the transmission lines go from those plants in the east to the consumers in the east. suddenly we've had wind turbines going up in the western side of the state for several years now, to the extent that Texas is now the largest generator of wind power, produces wind power. But we don't have any, we don't have sufficient transmission lines, I should say, to get the wind from the western part of the state to the eastern part of the state. Wind developers reacted favorably. I'm so sure. Of course they do. The lack of transmission has been a fundamental issue in Texas, said Vanessa Kellogg, who is the Southwest Regional Development Director for Horizon Energy. This is a great step. Public Citizen lauded the news. Tom Smith, many of you have seen Tom Smith here in Houston at different events. He says, Smitty as he's known, Smitty says, we think it's going to lower costs, lower pollution, and create jobs. We think that for every $3 invested, we'll probably see about an $8 reduction in electric costs. The transmission problem is so acute in Texas that turbines are sometimes shut off even when the wind is blowing. Boone Pickens, you may have seen Boone Pickens has been in the news lately. He's been running like a $60 million ad campaign. This is the legendary Texas oil man who says that we cannot drill our way out of our problems, and is a big fan of converting, or his plan, as it were, is to convert our automobiles to running on natural gas, which we have in more abundance than we have oil, and to move our electricity to wind power. And in his opinion, this is going to solve the problem. I've seen notices that there are people who disagree that this is going to solve it. At any rate, a spokesman for him, Jay Rosser, says he welcomes it. Of course, he plans to build what has been called the world's largest wind farm in the Texas panhandle. So if you own wind turbines, you're very happy to see this announcement. I'm trying to see how this thing is going to be funded. I'm not exactly sure, but I think it's going to be funded by state taxes. Not sure. We'll have to get back on that. But I think it's going to be funded by state taxes. It's not going to be funded by the wind industry itself. Though I could be wrong about that. Somebody might want to send me an email. How is this thing going to be funded? And you can do that by going to newcapitalshow.com. Okay, that does it for this segment. You were listening to the New Capital Show. www.newcapitalshow.com. This is KPFT 90.1 FM. I will be back with you in just a moment. We're going to pause for a short music break. Welcome back to the New Capital Show. Leo Gold with you. I am jumping around here today on my remote Portland-based diary. I covered recycling earlier, just a bit earlier in the show, but being that this is being recorded in segments, I've just received earlier today a facsimile of a letter that is going out from the Department of Solid Waste Management in Houston from Director Harry Hayes, who's the director of Solid Waste Management. And these letters are going out to certain neighborhoods. It says, dated July 7th, Dear City of Houston Recycling Customer, the City of Houston is studying the efficiency of its curbside recycling to ensure taxpayers are getting maximum return on investment in the program. There's that phrase, return on investment. This means the Solid Waste Department is studying the cost effectiveness of collections from neighborhoods where few residents recycle at the curbside. The most recent study of the current 162,000 participating households revealed that there were 23 neighborhoods involving over 23,000 homes which have a less than 10% set out rate for curbside recycling services. And Harry informs us that the national average for recycling set out is about 25%. So hang on, let's do the numbers here. There's 23,000 homes divided by 162,000 participating households. So 14% roughly of the entire program are households that are setting out less than 10%. That's right. 43 neighborhoods which have a less than 10% set out rate. And that involves 23,000 homes, or 14% of the total participating households in the program. Harry goes on to say, in too many cases, the department's trucks must drive through entire neighborhoods to collect only a few bins. Obviously, with the price of diesel fuel, equipment, and staffing, such minimal collections are not cost effective. And I would agree with that. That is not cost effective. With the price of diesel fuel, equipment, and staffing, that's not cost effective. But I'll get to my point in a second. He says, we are providing this information to all customers in hopes of improving participation rates. Well, that's what it's going to take, is hopes, because it isn't going to happen based upon the practicalities. I'll talk about that in a second. He's providing this information in the hopes of improving participation rates. So this is a letter sent to Houston households that are not recycling, warning these neighborhoods that are not recycling that they're going to be dropped. And he has hopes. He says, particularly in those 43 neighborhoods, those neighborhoods that do not improve their set out rates will be dropped from the program at the end of this calendar year. You got that? Those 43 neighborhoods, you guys that are not recycling more than 10%, with a more than 10% set out rate, you're going to be dropped by the end of the calendar year. As neighborhoods are dropped, others will be added to replace them. I encourage you to recycle and help the city protect valuable landfill space. Harry Hayes says this is valuable landfill space, which is contrary to the news that I got from another mayoral official, that in fact landfill space is so cheap that it's better for us to be throwing stuff in the landfill rather than recycling. So we're getting conflicting messages. Here's the point that I want to bring to your attention. Okay. The recycling rate in Houston is the way it is because the investments that have been made by the city have been made in a program that is not sound. The lack of returns that are coming from these neighborhoods and other neighborhoods and the city in general are not coming because the citizens of different neighborhoods don't recognize the value of the investments that the city has made. It's because the design of the program isn't sound. The investments are not sound. From the size of the bins to the materials that are collected, to the incentives that are built in, to the size of the garbage bin itself, all of these things are problematic. To the way the trucks are done, to where the sorting is done. The sorting, to my knowledge, is done there curbside, and you have a team of men who have to sort out the garbage by hand, have to sort out the recycling by hand right there curbside, where other cities have invested in centralized sorting facilities, so that all the truck has to do when it goes around is pick up the recycling all mashed together and dump it in the truck and take it back to the central sorting facility. This is the way that big city recycling is getting done these days. And our city has not made those investments. So there is an attitude at the mayor's office, and it's riven through this letter, that we Houstonians don't appreciate and are not providing the returns on investment that they have made. That is the problem. My friends, that's not the problem. The problem is that the city has invested in a program that isn't well designed and isn't working. Go back to the year 1990 and take a company called Microsoft. Okay? They released something, I think it was around 1990, called Windows 1.0. At the time, Microsoft was a company that had an operating system that was the dominant operating system on IBM compatible computers. It was called DOS. But DOS was not a thing of beauty. It was a command-driven, I'm sure many of you remember DOS. You got the old C prompt. Remember the C prompt? And to use the operating system to copy files, or to erase files, you had to know this arcane programming language. I actually liked it, but it clearly wasn't going to be something that the masses took up, although in fact they did. But basically people did workarounds to not have to expose themselves or be exposed to the operating system. So Bill Gates had seen the Macintosh and what a beautiful graphical interface it had, and they came out with something called Windows 1.0. This was basically something that covered up the DOS operating system. And it bombed. You know, it wasn't used. And then they came out probably a couple years later with Windows 2.0. You know, a little bit better, but it bombed. Now, imagine if you went back to Windows 1.0, and at the time Bill Gates had said, Dear customers of Microsoft Windows 1.0, you have not taken up on the investments that we have made, and we want to make sure that we're getting maximum return on investment, and therefore we're going to prevent you from getting Windows, and we're going to discontinue Windows. You know, imagine if that had been the case. No, that's not what Bill Gates and company did. They went back to the drawing board after 1 and 2, and they finally came out with Microsoft 3.0, which was the product that did the trick, that caused all those DOS users to convert over to a graphical user interface on IBM-compatible computers, and the rest is history. The rest is history. That's how projects work, my friends. That's how successful projects work. They don't look at the customers and say, we're dropping you. They look at their process and say, what's wrong with our process? What's wrong with our investment? Where are we not producing a product that is appealing to customers? And that is the whole problem with the city of Houston's recycling program. Not the customers. There's nothing wrong with the people in the city. They're doing exactly what the city is encouraging them to do, which is dump a lot of trash into a huge garbage can, which is free, and put a little bit of recycling into a little bin that is not weatherproof and that you have to carry out by hand, and that basically in the whole sum of a family's trash disposal is meaningless. We're going to post this letter from a Harry Hayes up on today's show, so you can take a look at it too. But this is my read on this letter. You know, again, blame the customers. You know, blame the customers. You guys are not doing recycling, so we're going to dump you. The problem isn't the people; it's the program. The problem is not the people; it's the program. The city's got to have to realize that. The people in charge of this have got to realize that, and it's crucial that the mayor realize that the problem is the program, and it needs to be redesigned. I've gotten a few emails also coming from a discussion that I had last week about what a fiduciary is with regards to investment advisors. I talked about last week what fiduciary obligation is and who has fiduciary duty. And I described to you that you would be surprised that different types of advisors in the world of financial advisory may or may not have fiduciary duty. And I think most of the public would be surprised at this. And I've been searching for a piece that would describe this very well, and I think I found it. W. Scott Simon is a guy I read a lot. He talks a lot and writes a lot about issues involved with fiduciary duty. Here's a piece he's got I'd like to bring it to your attention. It's called The Critical Difference Between a Stockbroker and Registered Investment Advisor. Scott Simon writes, maybe you've heard the word fiduciary mentioned a lot in the media over the past few years. A fiduciary is someone that manages money for the benefit of another, called a beneficiary. A fiduciary is bound by law to place the interests of its beneficiary first, before the fiduciary's own interest. And Scott Simon then says, as I said last week, you would think that anyone offering financial advice to their clients is a fiduciary. If you think that, you would be wrong. Stockbrokers, which also are called registered representatives, account executives, financial advisors, or wealth managers. You hear all sorts of names that are given to stockbrokers, but they're stockbrokers, are not fiduciaries. And that's with rare exceptions, even though they have engaged in high visibility advertising to portray themselves as full service investment advisors. Scott Simon recommends that you ask your stockbroker or account executive or whatever they are, if you're with one of the large firms, if he or she holds a Series 7 securities license. If he or she does, then it's probable that they are not a fiduciary. Not absolute, but it's probable that they're not a fiduciary. A registered investment advisor, however, also known as an RIA, subject to the Investment Advisors Act of 1940, that's the act that regulates and governs investment advisors, registered investment advisors, is a fiduciary. Again, a registered investment advisor is a fiduciary. The legal investment advising standards that govern a non-fiduciary stockbroker and a fiduciary registered investment advisor are very different. A non-fiduciary stockbroker follows only the so-called suitability standard, which doesn't require a stockbroker to place the interests of its clients ahead of its own. Under the non-fiduciary suitability standard, a stockbroker need provide only suitable advice to its clients, even if the stockbroker knows that the advice is not the best advice. Okay, you got that? The advice only has to be suitable. It doesn't have to be optimal. Only suitable, not optimal. A registered investment advisor, however, must follow the trust standard, the highest known in law, which requires it to place the interest of its clients ahead of its own and fulfill critical fiduciary duties of trust and confidence. Under the fiduciary trust standard, a registered investment advisor must provide its best advice to a client. Got that? An investment advisor must provide best advice. A stockbroker must only provide suitable advice. Even if a non-fiduciary stockbroker wanted to follow the trust standard of law and become a fiduciary to its clients, it probably cannot do so because of the contract it has with its broker-dealer, right? A stockbroker, say, at Merrill Lynch. Merrill Lynch is the broker-dealer, and the stockbroker is the stockbroker working at the broker-dealer. And the stockbroker has a contract with Merrill Lynch, or Smith Barney, or you pick it, you name it. Such contracts require the stockbroker to place the interests of the broker-dealer, you got it, before the interests of the stockbroker's clients. So in general, the allegiance of the stockbroker is to its broker-dealer, which you might think of as its employer, but it's really its broker-dealer before the interests of the client. A stockbroker then owes fiduciary duties only to its broker-dealer, not to its investment clients. A registered investment advisor owes fiduciary duties only to its investment clients because it doesn't have a broker-dealer. Okay? RIAs do not have broker-dealers. Investment advisors don't have broker-dealers. Stockbrokers, subject to the Securities Exchange Act of 1934, maintain that they are regulated heavily by the SEC, the National Association of Securities Dealers, NASDE, now known as FINRA, and or the various agencies in the states in which they do business. None of this less strict regulation concerning the suitability standard, though, registers stockbrokers with the SEC as investment advisors under the more strict regulation concerning the fiduciary standard of the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Got it? So stockbrokers may be subject to regulation under the SEC and other regulating entities, but not at the same level as investment advisors. Okay? So to sum it up, the critical difference between a stockbroker and a registered investment advisor is that the registered investment advisor is subject to the high fiduciary legal standard when providing investment advising services, while the stockbroker is not. Scott Simon finishes up by saying this difference could have a major impact on your investment portfolio and hence your retirement lifestyle. Let me say a word also about financial planners. Some financial planners may be fiduciaries. Some may not be. As I said last week, you need to ask. These are volatile times in financial markets. If you are not sure if your advisor or your stockbroker or your planner is a fiduciary, you should simply ask them. And if they say, "I'm not sure," then you can probably guess that the answer to the question is no. They are not fiduciaries. And finally, one more piece, and then I think that's going to just about do it for today's pre-recorded show, pre-recorded version of the New Capital Show. And one of the things we've covered before, most recently, David K. Johnston was on talking about tax evasion and how rampant tax evasion is among the wealthy and corporations and so forth in the United States. That's something that we have covered on occasion. I love this article from a few days ago from the Wall Street Journal. UBS. UBS is the big Swiss bank, which has been embroiled in all sorts of problems with the subprime meltdown, other scandals as well. UBS, which actually owns Paine Webber now, bought it a few years ago and absorbed Paine Webber. UBS has been involved in what apparently are tax shelters, tax evasion schemes marketed to U.S. individuals. And in Washington the other day, a UBS executive told a U.S. Senate panel that the Swiss company will shutter its private banking services that have served U.S. clients from Switzerland. Mark Branson, chief financial officer of UBS Global Wealth Management and Business Banking, remember, they're probably not fiduciaries, says that means UBS will no longer provide offshore banking or securities services to U.S. residents through our bank branches. While we are winding down this business, there will be no new accounts opened, and Swiss-based client advisors will not be permitted to travel to the United States for the purpose of meeting with U.S. clients. Why? Why did he make this announcement? Why did Mr. Mark Branson of UBS make this announcement? Well, here's why. The announcement came as Senate investigators unveiled a 115-page report detailing an aggressive effort by UBS bankers to market offshore banking services to wealthy U.S. clients. UBS officials are under investigation by U.S. law enforcement authorities for conspiring to help U.S. clients avoid taxes. This always blows my mind that people who are wealthy, the steps they go to avoid paying taxes, and often these taxes are the lowest taxes in the land. Right now, the long-term capital gains tax is 15%, and that's not low enough. I mean, you're already rich. You're facing, for many of these investment vehicles, the lowest investment tax, the lowest tax, one of the lowest taxes on any form of income in the land at 15%. That's not good enough. You know, it's got to be zero. It's got to be absolutely nothing. Can't pay any taxes whatsoever. And there are ways to pay no taxes. If you buy an investment in the United States and you never sell that investment, you hold it, and it's a good investment, and you never sell it, you never owe any tax. You don't owe a tax on an investment unless you sell it. That's still not good enough. They've got to go and take their assets and put them offshore. Mr. Branson appears to be fairly chastened here. He says, I'm here to make absolutely clear that UBS genuinely regrets any compliance failures that may have occurred. The U.S. loses about $100 billion. That's $100 billion annually, my friends, due to offshore tax evasion, according to the Senate probe, which is taking aim at UBS and Liechtenstein's LGT Group. Of course, Switzerland is a famous tax evasion haven for allegedly marketing tax evasion strategies to wealthy Americans. U.S. clients hold about 19,000 accounts at UBS with an estimated $18 billion to $20 billion in assets in Switzerland, according to the findings. Yeah, real patriots, huh? Real patriots. Well, my friends, that is going to do it for another edition of the New Capital Show. I hope these recorded shows are doing okay for you. I'm trying to get better at them. I'm trying to keep them topical and informative. You can reach me by email by going to newcapitalshow.com. There are links to email, links to older shows. And I want to thank you for hanging with me during this extended vacation. I hope you have a great week, and I will be coming to you again next week, again from Portland, Oregon. Until then, take care.
This Friday, KPFT and Pacifica Radio present the House Judiciary Committee hearing on the Imperial Presidency and possible legal responses, entitled Executive Power and Its Constitutional Limitations. For the last several years, many progressives, including a handful of Congress members, have called for the impeachment of President George W. Bush. But they have been stymied for 6 years by the Republican majority, followed by a Democratic leadership that took impeachment off the table. That may be changing. The House Judiciary Committee will take the first step to investigate what Representative John Conyers calls, quote, numerous credible allegations of serious misconduct, unquote. Pacifica Radio will broadcast this hearing live, starting at 9 a.m. While the panel of committee...
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.